Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Hope everybody is doing good. I mean, you know, we got hot, humid weather. Seems to be all over the place. I understand it's out there in New York, definitely here in Illinois. Denise, are you there by chance?
Yes, I am. I'm ready to get started.
What's the weather like in Colorado?
Raining every day and cool.
Just kind of lousy. Paul, are you there? Okay, hopefully Paul will come on. Denise, you got so much stuff, I can't even know where to begin.
Well,
I'm just feeling kind of lousy, too. This eye surgery, the clearing up of the eye, didn't happen as they intended, so we're back on some more powerful antibiotics. So,
oh, my.
Welcome to the reality of getting your eye zapped by depleted uranium, where the VA acknowledges it and does surgery, but the surgery takes longer to recover than normal. But I think that's when our immune system compromised. Isn't that normal?
Yep, and, you know, one of the things the VA doesn't do, and I'm pushing for two things that the War-Related Illness Center should add. One is a hematologist so that everybody gets a testing for hypercoagulation, and for people that don't understand medical terminology, what that means and what we found back in 99 and then has since been duplicated by Dr. Ron Bach at the VA, Minneapolis VA, is that we have thick blood. Now, the cause of that, we're not sure, okay?
Well, I remember I was part of that study, and you find mine, and my doctors down there at the VA in Alabama jumped on it immediately and put me on the heparin protocol for a while.
Right.
I remember you freaking that out, and when they actually ran the test and got the test results back, I mean, it was kind of like, this
yeah,
is
I had
not
to call
good.
You. You were at some camp or something, and I had to twist your arm long distance to get you to do it and stay there and get it shipped overnight. Federal Express with dry ice, as I remember. But that was our initial study back in 99 that was published in the Journal of Coagulation and Fibrinosis back around November, I think, of 99.
Yeah, I've got that article. I'll have to send that in where Gary can put that up on the website.
And the other thing is Dr. Ron Bach with the Minneapolis VA. You know, I was going to the Research Advisory Committee meetings, as I've done since they started. I've only missed two of those meetings. And here we were given a sheet of what all they were studying at the VA through the research and development of VA. And it had been stress. Stress studies out the kazoo. And that's one thing we have accomplished. If people are wondering about what the Research Advisory Committee has gained for us, we got them off the stress back in 04. It still continues to a small amount, but we refuse to let them go backwards and to create science. In fact, they try to create science and pull us back to the stress realm, and we keep fighting them on that. But Dr. Ron Bach had a study listed. And when I got home, I looked up the phone number and called him, and I'd sent him our original draft article and some other stuff that we had kind of looked at on the side that we hadn't included in the article. Interleukins that we were looking at that may cause that. And so I provided him this and found out he had some exciting preliminary results and he needed more money to continue. So I said, we need to get you invited to the RAC meeting, in which I called Mr. Benz and got him lined up to present. He presented in Boston, and I was floored. I had met him the night before when we came, and the hotel that we were using there was right next door, and they had a restaurant. So we were all meeting down to get something to eat after we got in the day before. And so I met him and some of the others that I had not met in person that I knew over the phone or by email. And we had talked. When he goes to present his talk, he starts talking about me, and I went, whoa, what the heck are you doing? And it was his way of giving me a surprise. I did not know he had been our original reviewer for a peer-reviewed journal article. And that was his way of surprising me at a meeting. So it was kind of funny. Had a laugh and went, what are you doing type thing. He had never shared that with me. And I said, you could have told me that when I called you and I was faxing you all the stuff from the original study. you know, here you had already gone through all that, being our reviewer. And so he took up the cause up at Minneapolis. I dropped back through, going back and forth to D.C. I can arrange going through Minneapolis and have a couple of hours and go over to the VA and cooperate with their study, give my blood, be consented, and give the blood. And he has had VA and CDMRP funding. He has published one or two articles since, but he is confirming what we found. He has put in some grants for treatment ideas. I don't know what he's proposing on that, but I know he's put in some grants for the round that's being decided now through CDMRP. So we're looking at treatment besides our low-level heparin. Now, why heparin? Well, if you really research heparin, it has an anti-inflammatory effect that not a lot of people know. They just think about it thinning the blood. But it does have an anti-inflammatory that Coumadin does not have. Coumadin wasn't recommended by Dr. Brewer, David Brewer, out at Hemex Labs. And since then, Dr. Brewer had a heart attack. He found what was called Belluc, which is nanokinase that helps. So there's, you know, we're looking at other ways to treat this. And my concern is with the strokes, the early cardiac, the pulmonary emboli, the deep vein thrombosis, all these could be combined, okay? And it could be something in the blood. So I'm recommending that, you know, the war-related illness centers get a hematologist there and being sure that these GUF-4 vets are getting tested for hypercoagulation so that we can treat them. And I truly feel we can save lives right now from those problems that I've mentioned. Nanokinase can be gotten at a vitamin cottage. You know, you can order it offline. I do have somebody that was on Coumadin that had a pulmonary emboli, and he also was taking CoQ10.
We've had way too many of these individuals that have died from emboli. I mean, we had a broadcast journalist that we personally knew that died. We'd worked with him. And then we also had a whole bunch of kids. I mean, we had one kid die here from St. Joseph, Illinois, where he had an emboli.
And
these were all young. No, they shouldn't have happened.
No. And it's not being tested on the vets, and that's why I got mad and walked out on the VA back in 1999-2000, was because I had a hematologist as my primary care. She told me her hands were tied, you know, couldn't do anything to help others get tested. She couldn't prescribe the heparin that they wanted me on low dose. Got totally frustrated with her, as only a nurse that was critical care cardiac can get frustrated when you're trying and showed them the papers and everything. So I think that's something that we do need to get tested on the vets, and there is treatment. Now, on the Coumadin, it doesn't have the anti-inflammatory effect, but one of our guys that's been on the program previously was on Coumadin, and then he started taking CoQ10, and the CoQ10, in fact, you know, was helping decrease his dose of Coumadin. So, you know, if you add something else as treatment, you need to be checked to see if that's altering, you know, the hypercoagulation. So he's been able to decrease his dose on Coumadin. And I don't recommend the Coumadin. The doctors recommended, you know, a low-dose heparin. But I do think that this needs to be looked at. It needs to be part of the testing done at every VA hospital, not just war-related. The other thing that they do not do is bring in an immunologist, and I think we have to get the viral testing. We have immune system damage, and that's only going to be shown if you do the viral testing and show, you know, that your immune system's affected. We have a lot of autoimmune disorders showing up in GUF-4 vets, so we need an immunologist on the team and actively involved in the research and getting the total picture put together. So that was one thing we changed. The rack was able to get them off of the stress. Like I said, it keeps coming back to that, and we keep fighting them on it. But people kind of put down the rack and say they don't recommend larger studies. The rack is there to review and analyze every research study that's done, whether it's VA, CDMRP, a chronic fatigue study that may relate, and, you know, analyze it. And it's up to the VA, Office of Research and Development, to decide to put out a, you know, RFP is what they call, and it's a research funding proposal that they call for research funding proposals to address those needs of doing a larger scale study. It is also up to the researchers if they see a study that's been promising and they can duplicate it and do larger scale. It's up to the researchers to put that in. And the RAC has been criticized lately by one or two individuals about them not recommending which studies should be duplicated. And I keep telling people that it's not their role. They analyze and look at all research that's done, put it into some context, and then it's up to the VAORD or the researchers themselves to say, yes, this needs to be, you know, done again, but with a larger number of people, whether it's the Georgetown fMRI studies with diffusion tensor technology, you know, no matter what it is. You know, there was never in the mission of the RAC to make recommendations. You know, maybe that can be pursued. But, you know, what we've tried to do and why we went to CDMRP was that the VA was, you know, kept studying stress. And the only way we could really get away from that and get some headway going on the research was, you know, having DOD with a congressionally directed medical research program, thanks to Dennis Kucinich and Senator Sanders, have pushed that. Now, we started out with $5 million for the first year. It has grown to we're getting about $20 million a year. But if you have a large-scale study, it's going to wipe out $20 million in no time flat. We will not have any money for any smaller studies to look at other things we need to look at.
You know, one of the things that's happening with the research things, and as I talk to researchers, they you know, we find out they're doing it, or they start looking on the Internet and start searching around to find the literature, find out who was involved, is you'll get a researcher at a university or something, has every intention of wanting to deal right, okay?
Yeah.
But what we find out is they're not given all the information. So the information that's out there as far as the epidemiology, what has happened as far as the toxic exposures, what's always been known as a result of the toxic exposures, just like this, the hypercoagulation's been thoroughly documented, not a question, and everything else. But all this stuff somehow doesn't get to them. And then
the published
articles are peer-reviewed, and you're not going to find very few peer-reviewed much peer-reviewed literature in these areas because nobody did it, or if they did it, they didn't connect.
Well, what I, having been on the peer review the first time at CDMRP, they did have a good review of all the causative factors, and I'm hoping they're still using that. I mean, it covered all the factors that we'd look at, Doug. They don't need to have the actual documents like you have that may help, but a good review of, you know, what are the things that we're looking at. But what we're really looking at is not so much nailing down if it's one exposure versus another. Is, you know, it's a combination. It really is.
Well, it's a whole. The whole thing has been a synergistic relationship from the get-go.
But what we have to do, and, you know, when I was out in Palo Alto, you know, I sat down with the head doctor there and his researcher, and they said, you know, we're not putting down any potential cause. But we look at, like, TB, and they have an idea of how that might be affecting the pain that we're having. So they're looking at symptoms and what can we do to treat these symptoms and get people a better quality of life. They have a good idea. You know, they had a reasonable, very low amount to do the research, and they had it all set up, wouldn't need equipment. You know, just need the approval and the additional funds to get started. And I, you know, pointed them to the VA ORD, you know, that their ideas sounded very legitimate. And so hopefully they will pursue that and we'll have something working there. But, you know, they were looking at a potential new drug that's approaching FDA approval that might help, particularly if it's this. You know, I'm kind of talking in vague generalities because I really can't expose what they were looking at until, you know, they propose it and see if it gets funded. But there are people, and what we're trying to emphasize is diagnosing, having the appropriate diagnosis being made with the appropriate diagnostic tools that are available now. A lot of the tools that are out there, fMRIs, DTs, are for research. But do we need to, you know, do something about that and get it out of the research realm and to actually be in use so everybody can get diagnosed appropriately?
Yeah. Hey, Paul, are you Paul there yet?
Treatment.
Paul, are you, have you called in yet? Okay. Go ahead,
okay,
Denise.
So, the hypercoagulation is one area that I truly feel we could treat. Another area that's being neglected is immunology. And there's been a lot of work with civilian chronic fatigue on that, that we need to look at that because we may have viruses that could be treated. I know Stanford University looked at, you know, using Valsalcovir, and that helped a lot of people, and that was in the civilian chronic fatigue world. We haven't duplicated that type study with the GovHor vets. So, you know, you have to kind of break it down to what could be causing these symptoms, how can we treat these people, including you and I, Doug, to, you know, get them better. May not be a complete cure, but at least, you know, take down the pain, improve the memory, cut down on the rashes, you know, make life more livable and manageable.
I think the right now with the weather changes and everything, this has been the weirdest weather lately here. I can't even begin to describe it. The chronic fatigue, which has nailed my butt right now, and the pain levels can get out of control.
And we see that, you know, the approaching winter, cold fronts, we see the change of pain. We also see increase in pain. And, you know, I tell people, you've got to know what exposures you're getting day to day, too. You know, if you're in construction work, what kind of paint are you using? The carpet and the glues used in carpet. You know, if you're living in an agricultural area, are they spraying? This isn't really the season for spraying as much as, you know, early in the spring. The other thing is, as you noticed, when we were in Dallas one time and you were hungry when you got off the plane and I took you to the only place I knew right off the bat that was close to where we were staying, and I ended up getting very, very irritable. And I remember you looking at me like, what is going on with her? And, you know, because I, you know, met you at the airport and, you know, everything was fine. And it took the second time of going there and then conferring with our Dr. Ruth that was there that that motel coffee shop and restaurant was known to have mold problems. So we have to watch out when it gets to be winter time and when you're closing up your house. Do you have any mold in your house? Because that can trigger the symptoms too. You've got to
There was one restaurant that we ate with, I think it was in Richardson, where I got real sick and we couldn't go back in there again. And it was just, I mean, the food combinations or the aromas or whatever triggers a synergistic response.
Well, you know, you have to look at, you know, if they've had a bug problem and treated with pesticide, you know, that's going to trigger us. You know, a lot of things, you know, if you've had any kind of insect problem and had, you know, your house exterminated, that can trigger it. You know, when you get in with the civilian community and the local, you know, areas, a lot of them can tell you, don't go to that place. You know, I don't know what it is about that place, but if we go, we get sick. So, you know, there's environmental exposures. I cannot really be around chlorine. I get a reaction to chlorine. And you have to decipher this out. It could be cleaning products that your spouse brought in and used. That's happened to me. I had, you know, my pine trees here, and we have the pine beetle. And so, you know, rushing around, not thinking, and, you know, I okayed them to do it, and then all of a sudden I had the memory fog. I mean, it was terrible. I couldn't think. I couldn't do the simplest things. And come to find out, it was what they had sprayed my pine trees with. You know, so you can get further exposures, and you've got to be aware of the exposures. And if you have, you know, if you've leveled out and you're not having problems and then you start having problems, you better be looking at what you're using in your home. What is triggering this to, you know, push you over that curve again?
Yeah, one of the other things, too, and I've raised up this question before and we discussed this.
And that includes, let me not forget, that the military that were stationed on the bases that have been put on the chemical contaminated list or, you know, have been, you know, closed because of that, or even the ones currently, like down in Alabama, Fort McClellan.
Yeah, Fort McClellan's there, and then Chinook Air Force Base right here. We got McClellan Air Force Base in California. They're all over. I mean, you can go to the, look up, okay. Just go onto ATSDR or any of the things for the EPA.
Type in chemically contaminated bases on a Google search, and it'll pull up the appropriate
The actual EPA stuff, military Superfund sites will show up all the lists and what the contaminants are, and it's staggering. But again, that goes back to all the work that the rest is trying to do to get on these, airborne hazards and everything, which is all the toxic chemical compounds from everything, and, you know, all that stuff together get analyzed. And again, without the risk, we wouldn't have that coming out, and so that's important to look at. I know.
I mean, we have vets that tell us during Christmas they can't go shopping, they can't go buy those perfume and aftershave aisles.
Yep.
Going grocery shopping, they have to avoid the aisles with the detergents and the bleaches and the cleaning solutions. You can get it if, you know, whatever cleaning products they're using in stores. And if you walk in and start getting the foggy brain, as I call it, or, you know, start not feeling right, you need to exit and get out of that location and think about what it was that exposed you. Because our system, you know, our bodies are very nicely balanced in normal life. But when you've been hit with toxins and toxic damage, it doesn't take a whole lot to, you know, trigger you more. And it was just like our F-16 pilot, Mike Donnelly. He was doing pretty well. He was flying his aircraft, F-16s. He was up at Wichita Falls. He was doing his running. He ended up behind the machine that was fogging the base for mosquitoes. And
well,
that was what tipped him over.
The exposures. My producer just came online, and our guest is sick. So you know how he trips up and down with exposures in the weather, so he's sick again right now.
I know we wanted to mention the war-related illness. And basically, people, we have three centers that deal with war-related illness. And if you just type in warrelatedillness.va.gov, you get the page about the war-related illness centers. And over on the left-hand side, it will tell you referrals. You click on there, and you will find the information that is needed for your primary care physician at the VA to refer you. Now, the VA has not done a good job in educating their primary care physicians about the war-related illnesses. I've had vets have to go in with an iPad, pull it up for them and show them how to refer people. My doctor at the VA, she said I was the only one she's ever heard about it from, and she referred me. So it's not that they won't refer you, they're just not aware. When I was out in Palo Alto, I met quite a few vets that live there in California that had been referred from other places in California. One of them had a neuro consult at Palo Alto, they were not completely happy. They wanted more information, more assessment. That neurological assessment did not know, that neurologist did not know they had the War-Related Illness Center sitting right there, right behind the main hospital. Is a separate building, building flies. And War-Related Illness is on the fourth floor.
That's the thing that bothers me. You've got all these hidden assets, or assets that are not shared or not discussed, and that's inexcusable. I don't understand why.
I was meeting vets left and right out there, and it was funny because I had met a Vietnam vet. He had gotten through it, and yet I was meeting Gulf War vets and OIF vets that had no idea. No one had told them about it, and I'm sitting there passing out their brochures, their pamphlets. And each of us have gone, the real diligent ones have gotten a stack of those, and we take them to our local VA and get them distributed, to every team. But, a lot of them are not thinking what they could do to help their fellow veteran by picking up a stack of those and helping get them out to their VA facility so that it increases awareness.
Well, that comes back to being the advocates. I mean, not only are the vets, you and I and Paul, who's sick again tonight and can't join us, and all these other ones have been the advocates, where the other people that should have been advocates abdicated the responsibility. And that just bothers me more, because I was in the post office here the other day, and I ran into one of my old command sergeant majors. And as we're going in, his respiratory was bad and his eyes were bad. And I said, "Hey, boss," it's like, "Oh, no." And I said, "I just came back and here's my new prescription." He says, "I'm getting to the doctor." So here we're seeing the same thing over and over again, where we have total confirmation of exposures with individuals that work together. And yet they didn't, as you said, they didn't even know.
Yeah. Those of us have been around, we knew when they started doing the War-Related Illness, and it's taken, a long time to get the word out there. So, the VA needs to do a better job on that, no doubt. Need to notify their physicians. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things, when I came back from the April meeting, when we had a new RAC report out, I went and took it to the VA hospital, went down to the admin section, and the admin assistant there said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, they've got a new report out, and I think you need to notify all the physicians. And here's a website where they can get to it. They can read it. Here's one copy for you." I didn't have a lot of copies of it. But I said, here's the website where they can read it. And so she was going to, put it out as information for all the doctors at the VA Denver. Now, I don't know if she did. I need to go back and follow up with her, which I will be, to take her the War-Related Illness pamphlets and get them out there. But we all need to do our part. And, the VA... like the town hall meetings. I got upset because I was having to hunt them down for the town hall meetings. They're supposed to have at every VA facility and at the VA regional offices. He didn't just say the health care. He said regional offices, too. I was having to have Google searches to find if they put out a press release. I was looking on Facebook to see if the VA hospitals and facilities each had a VA Facebook page, and then also the Visions, which is over, a large area, maybe several states on each Vision. So I had to look through there. I got on the VA website and went in and jumped on every email list I could subscribe to. So I'm getting some of it through the Vision email, through the public relations. But people don't know when the meetings have occurred. So I got kind of frustrated the other day, and I called VA headquarters in D.C. And I said, "This is ridiculous. The secretary deemed that they should be doing this within, 60 days or whatever he said, that every VA and, you know, benefits people should be having these. And I said, you don't have it on the front page of the VA website. You know, and going in there and trying to search on the VA website, I couldn't find it. You know, and I said, it'd be simple. List them all on the front page. Have one, you know, have a link, say all VA town hall meetings, a listing, because they should be notifying the head office of when they're scheduling it and the details. So the, you know, headquarters, the computer people should be putting a full list out. They haven't done it yet, but well, I'll probably be calling them again and saying, you know, if you want to communicate, and I've already found Gulf War vets that said it happened before I knew they were having them. So they missed the chance to go if they wanted to.
Well, you know, that's the same thing as what we have happening here. I mean, I've got a meeting scheduled with the new Danville, Ileana VA medical director coming up in a couple of weeks. But I haven't seen anything about a town hall meeting. And in the past, when we've had town hall meetings or get-togethers or reviews, they were so hidden from anybody that nobody would know about them. And even the same thing, and I had to really push with our local congressman and everything with the VA to even get notices put up in the VA when we had congressional hearings or congressional actions, you know, like a work job thing or a resource fair or whatever. So it's kind of like we're here, but we're not going to be the advocate.
Let me tell
we're not going to inform you.
I will inform you right now. The Hines VA had one scheduled for the 27th. They changed it to September the 4th, and that's in Chicago, I believe. Hines VA Hospital Town Hall Meeting. September 4th at 10 a.m. in the Hines Auditorium.
So anybody in the Chicago area that goes to Hines VA Hospital is at what time? September 4th at 10 a.m.?
That is correct.
Okay,
let me go through some of these that I just posted today. VA New Jersey, the Lions campus, will be on Friday on the 5th of the month. That's just next week at the Lions campus, building 143 at 1 to 3 p.m. Let's see, this one's in Huntington, which I think is in West Virginia, Huntington VA Medical Center, town hall meeting on September 9th. I don't have the other details on time on that, but you should contact Vision 9, and John Patrick is the director of the VA Mid-South Healthcare Region. VA in Massachusetts. There's VA Boston Healthcare System, Monday, September 15th at Jamaica Plains Campus, Jamaica Plains, Massachusetts, from 6:30 p.m. to 7:30.
Now, that's a lot more sense, because if they're going to get the vets to come in, and most vets that are sick or if they're working, they can't take off a job to go to a meeting. They have a problem even getting the time off to go to medical care. And when you have something as critical as a town hall meeting, that needs to be rather lengthy. And in the evening or on the weekend when the veterans can get there and family members can get there, because
right.
I think it's critical in both, you know, I mean, you're a military family forever.
Uh-huh.
You know, whatever, what else can I say?
Let me go on and run through these if people are listening. Phoenix VA Healthcare is rescheduled for September the 19th, 6:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. And that will be in the conference room located in the basement of the ambulatory care center.
So it needs to be where both the spouses and the family members and the sick veteran can get there. So it has to have all these people involved, because if the family member knows what's happening or they need information, they need to bring that out. So we have to have the educational component. We have to have the coordination component. And then the sheer numbers of family members are taking care of sick vets. I mean, we're still trying to get those bills through this through Congress to ensure optimal, you know, funding for that, and that's a problem. So these town hall meetings have to address all of this, don't they?
Yeah, Bay Pines VA over in Florida, St. Petersburg VA regional office. That's where your claims are decided. People will have their town hall September 3rd, 8:30 a.m. to 12 o'clock p.m. I mean, I've just got a whole list of these that are having them, and some of them were passed before we knew to, you know, how to find them. So I will be calling VA headquarters again on Tuesday, believe me, because they need to repeat these. Cheyenne's having one at their VARO on Tuesday, September the 9th, from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. That's the Regional Benefits Service Center.
Denise, can you make sure and email those to archives@garynoll.com so our producer can get those up?
Sure.
We definitely need to have those, and if you send them direct or send the link direct, then the archives can put them up there, and we get them posted, people can find out about them. The one thing else I wanted to bring up, and it's just on the news again tonight, and you were a military family, so you've been in, and you're a Colorado and Texas girl and everything else. You know, they brought up this thing where they had this young girl that was all trying to shoot an Uzi at a range or something and happened. You know, and the whole question was raised and was on our local news right before the show started again, whether kids should be involved in guns. Well, I mean, all of us raised with guns, and kids were raised with guns and safe. But I think this crossed into a whole other ballgame, because when you give a child or even most adults an automatic weapon, it's hard for them to handle them, because, I don't know, what about you?
They've had shows, I can't remember if it was probably CNN, that did shows showing kids at gun ranges. And people that believe in their gun rights have no problem with having their kids go. My problem... You know, maybe they'd be okay with a pistol, but you put this was an Uzi with a 9-year-old girl. Even with an adult, an Uzi carries a pretty good whop, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what I'm getting into, and I think you and I are totally in agreement. I mean, the child needs to learn and be around it. But, I mean, even adults that we had when we were training, when I was on the range as a training officer or a medic on the range or, you know, running the ranges as an actual range officer, Fort McClellan, I had adults that could not handle an M16 on full auto,
yeah,
much less anything else. So the idea that you're going to put some weapon like this in a child's hands and expect them to hold it when the adults can't, because if anybody can try this, if you've been in the military and all of us have done this, I mean, everybody likes to rock and roll. But when we put that 20-round clip on or a 30-round clip on full auto in an M16, you couldn't hold it on target. It was racing all right,
well,
going all over hell.
Doug, I believe in gun rights, okay? But, you know, when you can't get a driver's license and, you know, a learner's permit until, what, 15, 16? And, you know, then, you know, you don't get your full license usually in most states until you're a little bit older, a year or so down the road. But, I mean, if we will not let them drive a car, what are we doing putting them in automatic weapons? I mean, really, people, there's got to be common sense. And, you know, young kids don't have the comprehension of death at all.
They don't have the strength to hold it. I mean,
when we first started
learning, we had a single-shot 22 and we had a single-shot shotgun.
And when did you start learning, Doug?
Probably 6 or 7 years old, but we didn't progress up until I was in high school or older to where you got into anything more than the single shot, you know what I mean, or bolt action. And I was in the military before, you know, well, obviously you're not going to see any automatic weapons.
Well, it depends where you live, too. If you're rural and you hunt, you know, your kids are going to get exposed earlier. Okay.
But you still have to have common sense. And this breached every sort of common sense, because...
I couldn't even comprehend taking youngsters younger than 13, you know, unless they've been raised on a farm, gone hunting with their parents, you know, have had a lot of training. And I know a lot of... military service organizations have training programs. I think the associate group to the ZFW, the Sons of the Legion, I think does some of it. The VFW auxiliary unit with the men have, you know, gun safety programs. You start them with a gun safety program, and you don't go up to automatic weapons. I mean... I just, you know, the strength in their arms are not there.
But that's what we see on adults, because, I mean, I got to come back to it. New recruits that I had, or even seasoned, you know, military officers, all right, they could not handle it properly when we flipped into full auto. That was a reason why the M16 was changed, you know, back to, you know, individual or just a three-round burst.
Well, even with your 38s, they have a kick, and your hand's going to go up unless you're trained and, you know, you get used to that.
Correct.
You know?
I mean, a lot of people can't hold a 45.
Your arm is automatically going to go up, and you have to realize you have to correct for that, and it takes strength. Even with a 38 with a handgun, and, you know, we're getting off the subject of health and all, but, you know, I wonder about people's common sense in this world.
You know, Ed, we got to bring this up, and the same thing comes down to it again. You got to watch your, you know, your medications. You got to, you know, again, alcohol, all this stuff comes into play. You know, because it just burned my cross when I saw this and heard about this disaster. And then they're talking about, well,
there was people living close to that range that had filed a lawsuit. And they, you know, they knew. They were, you know, lived close to it, were worried about it, because the range was even close to a private airport. It was that close that, you know, you could get, you know, shells flying over the airport.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, ranges, again, we got to look at stuff. We got to remember, you're looking at max range on an M16 or something. You know, you're talking about maybe 100 yards or 250 yards. This stuff doesn't fly, you know, miles and miles and miles. You've got all the ballistics and you've got the physics, so all this stuff drops. If you're in a standard thing, it's going to drop off pretty fast, and you got all the berms around. But, again, it comes back to the same thing within the military. We didn't put the guns in the hands of even military personnel unless they could handle them and they were properly trained. And we found out we couldn't do it. So whether no matter what type you're using, the common sense approach, I think, needs to come back into this. And
I mean, how many times have we heard, you know, not so much about this little girl, 9 years old, and she's going to have to live with that memory, okay? And 9-year-olds do not have a strong concept of death, you know? But how many times do we hear about kids shooting, you know, another little boy or a little girl in their house showing off a weapon?
All the time. It's not all the time, but it happens too often. And this comes back to common sense again and everything else. It's just like when you're raised on a farm and all of us are, you know, rural people and everything else, you know you don't touch it. I mean, that's a given thing. It's not touched. You know, whether you're working with an axe or if you're working with a rifle or a shotgun or, you know, whatever your machete, whatever you're working with, you know, This is what's off limits and what needs to be done. But again, I mean, I just saw this and it just burned my craw because it didn't make any common sense. I'm saying, I didn't give my soldiers automatic weapons and allow them to go to full auto because they couldn't handle it.
Well,
and
you
now
know,
we got
what
a
was
9-year-old.
It wasn't that long ago in this past year that one of our special forces type guys, I think it was in Texas area. You know, they were trying to help a fellow vet, and they took him out to the gun range, and he ended up turning the gun on, you know, a special ops person, you know, trying to do a good turn and, you know, get a veteran out and doing something, you know. I mean, that wasn't a year ago, you know.
That was a super sniper.
And, you know, his family said, you know, my God, if they had talked to us, you know, we would have told them not to take him out. He was already talking about harming himself or whatever, you know. And, you know, people just do not collect their info and think. You know, we could go around and around on this, Doug, but, you know, I just think that there is a lack of common sense.
You know, the reason I brought it up with you is because, I mean, you and your husband are both military long-term. You're both retired, and you've got a daughter that's been raised in the military and the rural and the farming environment. So
no, she was mainly an urban girl.
An urban girl that's got a full-blooded Texan mother ain't no urban girl.
Well, anyway. like I said, we need to, you know, get back to our Gulf War illness here.
Yep.
And we've had a, you know, diversion here about talking about gun safety and, you know, the craziness that goes on. And it breaks my heart, you know, anytime I read about, you know, kids taking a gun to school to show off, not knowing any better, their parents not even being aware of it, or, you know, taking the gun out when their friend's over and ending up, you know, shooting a friend in what they have to live through the rest of their life. Much less taking somebody out to a shooting range, a 9-year-old girl, and having her try to control a Uzi. You know, come on, guys.
Thank you very much. I mean, I think we've said it all.
Yeah, we've beat this horse to death, I think.
I had to bring it up, though, because, I mean, you got two crazy majors here that have been around this all their lives and are total advocates and everything, but again, having been the medical, we had to pick up the pieces and understand the psychology and everything involved in this stuff, and there's some things that are just flat stupid.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to judge their strength, their knowledge base, their age grouping. You know, some of these kids are, you know, struggling with accomplishing tasks for a normal person their age. You know, they're not fully developed. They're little people.
You know, that was a reason, though. We'll go back to the Vietnam ages when they got the Giants to handle the M60. They didn't give it to some little pipsqueak like you and I.
No. You know, to carry that thing, I mean, I have a picture of me holding one at Escon Village. I was going, God, I couldn't do this. You know, no way. You know, I guess if I was forced to in a, you know, all-out situation, okay. But, I mean, you know, I just sat there and went, boy, this sucker's heavy. You know, just carrying it, you know.
Well, neither you or I were, you know, real big giants at the time we went to war in Desert Storm.
Yeah. But I don't know, Doug. And, you know, we have such a suicide rate with our veterans. And one of the first things, you know, if we're going to talk about suicide, you got warning signs, you need to get them to the vet center, if nowhere else. And I've been pushing the vet center because vets can get in easier to the vet center. And they now communicate fully with their VA psychologist. If they need help, they're going to holler out their fellow vets that understand. They do marital counseling and all kinds of stuff at vet centers now. These were set up and fought for by the Vietnam vets.
Yeah, that's critical because we just had another incident here in Champaign County where they dispatched a SWAT team instead of dispatching the trained team. And then, again, it just got out of control. But it's got to be some more common sense put in there and getting these resources. Like, you know, we have the resources we put together.
You know,
there are chaplains at the VA and response teams all set
up. One of the first things is, you know, talk to their family. And you've got to take the weapons away from them. If they have had depression severely, or talked about suicide or not wanting to go on, you don't want weapons around them. You know, they have other means. I mean, I've got a vet that slipped both of his wrists, you know, trying to keep up with him long distance now. But he's had problems before, and I go, oh, my God, you know, we almost lost him. And, you know, both of us having had medical, you know, you just... you know, his significant other was in the house, and luckily, you know, she was able to call for help. But this, what can I say, you know? Suicide is at an epidemic level in the military, and with our veterans, I think it's only going to get worse. They're trying to get more mental health people into the VA. Our secretary of the VA has even gone out recruiting now. He's gone to Duke already once for a recruiting drive to get doctors involved. A lot of people are very down right now. We've mentioned the town hall meetings. And people said, well, we had town hall meetings before. Well, we had the Office of Special Investigation running around. And we know how that worked, don't we, Doug?
Unfortunately.
We
got sucked into that up in Washington, D.C. I mean, we're sitting there and they're saying, we're going to help you guys. We're going to do everything we can. And all they did was gather information, put up roadblocks. And then when they're even their own staff said, we got a real problem.
The VA has had a lot of problems. And I'm for giving this new secretary a chance. And he's had quite a few problems. I mean, Philadelphia put out the grumpy thing, you know, the Sesame Street character in the garbage can. That was last week. You know, the VA makes errors. There's a lot of people involved in the VA. And, you know, we have to give him a chance. You know, hopefully he can turn the system around. Hopefully he does have, you know, a heart and want to do the right thing. And I think he does.
I think he can put that around. I totally agree with you. But we have to see without, and this is a recommendation, where everybody in the VA becomes an advocate for the veteran and their family members at all times and shares information and gets help for them. And when they can't help them, they admit they can't help them and go find the help.
Right.
I mean, the problem I had the other day
you know,
is they said...
Right now I'm babbling people saying, why go to these town hall meetings?
Yeah.
Well, number one, I know that the one in Phoenix and other ones, they brought in the Legion Crisis Center. And they were able to get help from many vets when they did that. And I, you know, think there needs to be more of that coordination being done. But, you know, the ones having it at the regional center, if your claim's been denied and you do not understand, the Guffaw illness example, presumptives are there, and you can show them the paperwork and bring it up that, hey, our denial rate on a Guffaw illness, multi-symptom chronic problems, you know, I've got to, you know, ask you why you regulated this way, you know, and be able to have discussions and not just have a town hall, but have people there that will talk to you and look at your claim and say, well, you know, we may have made an error here, you know, but we've got to at least give a chance. And if you're given an opportunity and there's a town hall meeting at the VA and you have the concern about the doctors not being educated about, you know, Guffaw illness, you need to speak up. Yeah, you know, you need to identify the problems. And hopefully there's enough, you know, Guffaw vets that go and speak up that, you know, it will make an impact on them. We also have to, you know, go to the VARO, which when I've just noticed, you know, several of them, you know, having town hall meetings. And like I said, the secretary not only said health care facilities, but the regional offices. And I, you know, normally you don't have very much interaction when you go put your claim in with the VARO, and then you get it back, and if it's denied, you know, you're told, you know, go do a notice of disagreement or start an appeal process. Instead of sitting down with somebody and saying, could this have been an error on your part? Do we have to gum up the system more, or can we get it fixed now? And, you know, if we don't take the opportunity, we gain nothing. If we take the opportunity, maybe there's a 50-50, 60-40, that some changes can occur. But if we sit back and not go and not express our thoughts to them, then we lose. There is a no-win situation there if you just say, oh, it's not worth my time.
You're absolutely right. And I think one of the big problems we ran into is people have put their claims in. I know what happened to me. And then they expect the Department of Defense, wherever St. Louis, and that's now Fort Knox, or wherever the center is. There was a center, I think, out on the West Coast for the at Lowry. But when they don't have the documents, they don't submit the documents because the documents disappeared from the military side. And the vet is going, I'm sick, I know this happened to me and everything, but I don't have any documentation.
And how many of them that were sick, except for the ones we had to air-vac Doug, are actually treat in theater? You know, they may have had symptoms and didn't acknowledge it. I mean, they're typical. You know, some of these kids were 18, 19, 20.
Correct.
We look at the teenagers in life. Teenagers in life do not think anything bad can happen to them.
Yep.
Okay? That's why you get automobile accidents. That's why they go out drinking and they have an automobile accident, end up killing somebody, hurting somebody. They don't have that comprehension that this can happen. And so, you know, they're healthy and, you know, they just deny. You know, denial is a very strong thing. They don't acknowledge that, hey, this shouldn't be happening to me. You know, and I remember early on when they were coming to Fitzsimmons, and, yeah, the doctors were giving them the runaround, okay? And they were saying, well, it's just because of your age. And I turn around and go, how old are you? I'm 24. I go, oh, this is bullshit. Wake up. you're 24 and having these symptoms. A normal 24-year-old, go to a college campus, go talk to some 24-year-olds. They're not having that problem. You know, they just, you know, they took the word of their whatever, you know, faith in their government, not knowing the history of Agent Orange, atomic vets, World War One with the gas, you know, they didn't know that part of history, and they just accepted that their government would never put them off or never lie. And sorry, history has taught us that we've had to turn around and fight. You know, Agent Orange vets had to fight.
Well, you know, on the Agent Orange, I think the Vietnam Veterans of America is the only website where you're going to find the Zumwalt report on Agent Orange exposures and confirmation. It's, I mean, it's up there on the Vietnam Veterans website, but I've never found it on the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, the Marines. I've never found it on the Department of...
You know, when I traveled, I've run across Vietnam vets. I guess we recognize each other. I don't know. But, you know, I'd find out, well, they had diabetes and we were having heart problems. And I go, do you know that's a presumptive now? No. You know, they didn't know. No one was telling them that, you know, they... You know, obviously didn't catch the news reel when it was reported once or twice, you know. And, you know, they don't think. I mean, when I got off, when I was deactivated and all, there wasn't really any good briefings on, you know, your health care, or else you were so intent on just getting home, you just kind of blew it off, you know.
I saw that happen way too many times, because especially with the Guard and the Reserve, they've been activated, and now they want to get back to their job and their family and everybody, so they realize if they say anything, what happened to Sergeant Professor Rollo Dolph, they kept him on active duty for another 6 months because of his health status when he came back from our team and he was sick. So instead of getting off when they came back in May of 1991, people stayed around until the fall.
They needed to identify themselves. They needed to get a line of duty determination. And no one ever taught that, okay? No one ever taught that. You know, you were taught about your chemical gear and everything. Here comes the music. We've ended up over an hour here now.
Again, thank you very much. And hopefully, Paul, if you're listening, hope you get better. We got to check on him, Denise. Take care, and thank you very much.
Okay.
We'll talk to you later.